I'm Earlonne Woods.
I'm Nigel Poor. We're the hosts and creators of Ear Hustle from PRX's Radiotopia.
Ear Hustle is a show about life inside prison, but it's not your typical prison podcast.
In this next season, we've got stories about the objects people keep inside their prison cells.
About residents in a women's prison who say they want to stay there.
And the most beautiful prison garden. Earlonne, I will never forget it.
Ear Hustle. Stories about life on the inside, told by those who live it.
Find Ear Hustle wherever you get your podcasts.
You love free, and at Ameris Bank, so do we. That's why we're proud to offer worry-free, hassle-free Ameris Bank free checking. Manage your money your way with convenient access to digital, mobile, and telephone banking, all with no monthly service fee or minimum balance requirements. At Ameris Bank, we're with you. For more information or to open an account, visit our local bankers in person or online at amerisbank.com/free checking. Other fees such as overdraft fees may apply. Ameris Bank, member FDIC, equal housing lender.
Dennis O'Hare here in your feed this week with an extra helping of political breakfast. Now, you might have heard there are primary elections coming up May 22nd. Georgia Democrats and Republicans will head to the polls to pick the Pauls, who will compete to be the state's next governor. In advance of the primaries, I've been sitting down with all of the major party candidates to get their views for the state. And you can look for those interviews Wednesdays and Fridays in our podcast feed. And this is the next interview in that series with Republican Hunter Hill. He's a former Army Ranger and former state senator. He was elected to represent a district in Fulton and Cobb counties back in 2012. He resigned that seat to run for governor last year, and he currently heads a leadership development company. Senator, welcome. Good to have you.
Thanks, Dennis. I'm glad to be with you.
Let's talk money. You have called for major cuts and realignments in state spending. How would that work? Specifically, what would you cut in order to make sure that the state keeps its spending in line?
Things that are core competencies of government, public safety, transportation, and education, these are high return activities. We need to invest in these things. They're core competencies. But we spend billions of dollars in areas where the government is not equipped at delivering results. And you might want to call them, you know, areas of life change, but Medicaid, welfare, food stamps. I believe that if we want to truly affect change in people's lives, we need to empower ministries and nonprofits and make sure that people understand that there's brokenness in and around us, and we have to come together to lift these peoples out of their broken situation. But the government is not delivering results.
But in the nonprofit world, are any of those entities, let's just take Medicaid, for instance, food stamps, delivery of services to literally millions of people in the state.
Correct.
Are there any organizations in the private nonprofit world that are equipped, even with a network of them, to handle that kind of volume?
Well, so not today. And so you're obviously not going to be in a situation where you can move to zero spending today. That's not the goal. The goal is to say we can all agree that we want to deliver results in the areas of helping people, but the government hasn't done so. So let's back up and say if we want to start helping people, let's empower more folks to be involved in this process. And over time, I believe we can spend less money in the process and deliver greater results because we're partnering with ministries, nonprofits, and private citizens. But the bottom line is if we don't deal with long-term entitlement spending, we're $21 trillion in debt at the federal level, and the 50 states are administering these programs where we're not delivering results, and we're starving the core competencies of government from the needed resources they need.
So let's take Medicaid expansion, for instance. This is something the state has not done under the Affordable Care Act. It is in the process foregoing money that would come from the feds to help the state deal with the soaring costs of Medicaid.
Once you create that expectation where we've expanded an entitlement program, we need to make sure, look, we got to back up and say, is Medicaid delivering results for the people that we're already serving prior to making the decision that we should expand it? And I would say that we're not doing enough to help increase health outcomes for the least among us with the current Medicaid program. So we've got to change the way we're doing business, then we can deliver results, and then consider whether we would expand the program. But the bottom line is this, is that Medicaid, the government involvement in healthcare has driven up costs and reduced health outcomes.
How would you change the Medicaid structure then?
Well, I think we have to, again, Medicaid was created to be a safety net program, and it has grown through the years where it's basically, essentially, a Cadillac program, where then we, so the government's mandating that we provide services at every function of level to our citizens, but then the government only pays the hospital 76 cents on the dollar to perform the service. This is the reason for the rural health care crisis, because then there's a hidden tax on people that are private pay, where they're paying more than they should have to for the service to cover the shortfall.
And but is that the problem of the people who are receiving it, or is that the problem of the reimbursement rate that the federal government provides to doctors?
Well, I think it's the problem of a broken philosophy that suggests that people are going to be forced to be covered, but we're not going to pay the full freight. We need to be honest and say there are some services that we can provide, and when we provide them, we'll pay 100% of the cost, but we can't continue to expand and say that everybody should get 100% of the services. I think we need to look at what is going to be offered to people that are on a program where they're not paying in. And the reason that that's important is we don't want to incentivize people to not get a job and to not expand their life and move up to the next level.
But aren't most people on Medicaid in this state either children or working poor, people who are working, and sometimes two jobs? I mean, they're incentivized enough. They're just not making enough to afford private coverage.
Well, and therefore, there's the problem where you're actually incentivizing them to not make enough to get off of Medicaid and up to the next level of life.
And but how can they make enough if wages continue to be low for many, many, many of the jobs that they are educationally qualified for?
Well, again, I mean, America is a opportunity-based country, and I want to make Georgia the number one place in the country for opportunity and upward mobility. That's why I want to eliminate the Georgia state income tax, because I believe when you have opportunities increasing, then people will, these are the job creators, the innovators that are paying the vast majority of taxes, and we want to create an environment where that capital and that investment and innovation is welcome into our state, and I believe then more jobs will be provided and people will have upward mobility.
Let's talk about your proposal to eliminate the state income tax. Now, that represents roughly $16 billion or so in state revenue out of a budget of $26, $27 billion. So that's a huge amount of money that the state would be saying, okay, I'm not going to collect that anymore. I'm going to find some other way. What would be that other way?
Couple things on this. We have increasingly, we've increased our dependence on the income tax in Georgia to fund our government. We've got to think about why that's the case. Number one, we've shot buckshot through the sales tax code. We're going to have to restore that and elevate areas where the sales tax to our state can bring in more revenue. I want to do it mostly like Tennessee, where they have a broad-based consumption tax so that we can leverage our wonderful visitors to our state, folks in the underground economy, illegal immigrants, and you're allowed by taxing more people to do so at lower rates and allow people to keep more of their hard-earned money.
You said lower rates. If you forego a state income tax, doesn't that mean that sales taxes will go up?
Yeah, the sales taxes will go up. Our plan is to get to a 0% income tax over 7 years. We've got to balance our budget. We've got to maintain our AAA bond rating. But if you do it over time, then we can get to about 7% total, all in, at the state level. So you might be at about 10 or 11 at the full cash out, but you're keeping all of your hard-earned money, and you're not paying that 6% income tax anymore. And we're leveraging other folks that are not Georgia residents to pay into the system.
If you have a downturn in the economy, for instance, if you have a natural disaster, sales taxes are going to go down because economic activity goes down. And the argument has been, look, we need to have a mixed basket, if you will, of revenue sources in order to ensure stability, and sales taxes are too volatile to simply rely on those.
We need to live within our means. And so when times are good, we shouldn't just spend that money. So when you live on a consumption level basis, if times are good, you're pointing out that we're going to bring in a lot of revenue. We should not increase government spending just because times are good. We need to prepare that there might be some fluctuations as economies rise and fall. But I will tell you this, the income tax did the same thing. When we hit the downturn, income tax precipitated went way down, and we were not able to, we had to make drastic cuts to the budget. We need to live in the good times like we're forced to live in the bad as it relates to government spending.
doesn't the sales tax fall disproportionately, though, on low-income people? Because they're paying the same percentage of a sale, but they're not paying the same percentage of their income for sales taxes.
We have programs, safety net programs, to take care of people that are on hard times. There's no sales taxes on WIC and food stamps currently. But currently, though, in Georgia, you start paying 6% income tax just above $7,000 in income. So in other words, we're already charging income taxes on those that are not making high incomes. What I want to do is create an environment where our economy can grow and a rising tide lifts all boats. And you do that by doing three things: eliminating the income tax, doubling our investment in transportation, and elevating K-12 education.
But the state legislature just passed a bill to cut the highest rate at state income tax from about 6% to about 5.5%. Isn't that proof that we can cut taxes without jeopardizing, in the view of some anyway, not only the stability of our system, but the stability of our credit rating, for instance?
Well, I agree with you. And I will tell you that I'm glad that they lowered income taxes. But it was candidly a tepid approach in the sense that we lowered the income tax because the federal government lowered income taxes. And so we needed to keep pace with and not have a windfall to the state as a result of what the federal government did.
You said that we could double the state's investment in transportation without raising taxes. How? Exactly what kinds of numbers are we talking about?
Let's back up. In the 1970s, when Georgia and Atlanta was growing at a rapid rate, transportation was 15% of the budget. But we keep spending our money on all these other areas. Certainly, it's the rising cost of health care, social programs, et cetera. And transportation then dwindled down to 5% of the budget. But you have to invest in your infrastructure if you want to keep a robust economy. So what I want to do is a tax increase, which is what has been proposed in the past to fund transportation, is a justification for how we're spending the other 95% of the budget. If we prioritize transportation, as I intend to do as governor, then we're going to need to make other areas, where we're spending less in those areas.
And that's what I'm— But can you cut your way to getting enough money to meeting the huge needs of a growing state with big infrastructure problems like you just talked about?
Again, I'm looking at the numbers, and I look at states like Florida, where about 11% of their state budget goes to transportation. We were at 5, a tax increase passed. I voted against it, but now we're at about a 7.5% of the budget. I'd like to see us at 10, 11% of the budget, which means we're going to have to prioritize it in the budget process. That requires leadership from the governor's office.
But does it give you enough money, especially if you're talking about a regional transit system,
so,
for instance?
Not in the short term is the bottom line. When you underinvest in something for 40 years, you can't fix it in 1 year. Bottom line is we need to have the dedication and the commitment to begin the process of making investments in our infrastructure that have lagged over time.
The legislature recently passed a bill to allow 13 counties in the Atlanta area to decide whether to opt into a regional transit system and tax themselves, in effect, to do it. There's also about $100 million in bonds in the new state budget for transit. First of all, is that going to be enough? And secondly, is it time for the state, if you don't want to be borrowing, to put some serious money in the budget for transportation, state money?
Well, that's what I'm talking about. You know, I think that we need to make the hard choices and prioritize transportation in the main budget. We're not going to be able to make the investments completely out of bonds. I think the $100 million is a good start, candidly, but it's over a 10-year period. And I think there's more that we can do, but it's got to start with not, you know, just new and creative spending, so to speak, or new spending. We got to find areas where we're going to cut in the budget. That's why I want to do significant Medicaid reform. I want to work with ministries and nonprofits to help lift folks out of poverty and create opportunities in areas where the government has not delivered results. And there's money in the budget where we can shift over time to prioritize this core competency.
Let's talk about education. Governor Deal's new fiscal 2019 budget includes full funding for the state's quality basic education formula, which everyone on all sides admits needs to be redone, that funding formula. In the meantime, though, while we're working on that, would you commit as governor to continue to fully fund QBE until a change is made?
We have to look at making meaningful reforms that are going to deliver results. I'm not interested in putting new money on the table for the same old failed solutions of the past. We can't keep going with government-centric solutions. Many of the things you suggested are true, that if you just have charter schools, that in itself is not going to solve the problem. But I like the notion of having competition. When you look at private education, for example, you see some of the most robust markets of education and results in the marketplace right here in Atlanta. But that is only available to the top 1%. Were we to expand opportunities for other families that don't have the resources to send their kids to private school and give them that chance, I believe that we elevate all boats in education, because you're going to be creating an environment where people might leave a school, which just fixing schools through changing laws doesn't work. There's cultural issues at play here. And I don't mean cultural out in the culture. I mean the culture of public education needs to be elevated by forcing administrators and teachers and everyone to look in the mirror and say, what can we be doing better? We're losing schools. We're losing students to these other schools.
You talked about teachers a moment ago.
Mm-hmm.
The legislature has been pushing more dollars into the state's pensions for teachers and employees. Now, this is hundreds of millions of dollars and a significant amount of growth here, and it's likely to get even more as baby boomers retire. Would you favor continuing the state's teacher pension system the way it is and funding it the way we're doing now? Or do you say to teachers, look, we promised you this, but we're going to have to make some changes?
Well, let's back up. First of all, every commitment we've made to current teachers and current retirees, we owe it to them to fulfill those obligations. But we also need to be forward thinking and remind ourselves, what is the purpose of compensation and pensions? It's to recruit and retain the best possible teachers. And I think that we need to get caught up to date on how organizations do compensation. And the bottom line is we're having huge turnover rates in teachers years 1 through 5 because we're overwhelmingly valuing time and service over value in the classroom. And what I want to do is pay our teachers more for the value that they're adding today to our children. And then for retirement for new teachers, not current retirees, but offer new teachers more of a 401k option where they're going to manage their retirement going forward, because we're going to pay them good money while they teach. Right now, the model is we don't pay them well enough, but then we give them an excellent benefit for their retirement. And I'd much rather pay teachers more for the value that they're adding to our children today.
One of the areas of debate in this campaign has been whether the state should not only expand the list of conditions for which someone could obtain cannabis-based oil for treatment of those conditions, but whether the state should be involved in research and cultivation. Where are you on that?
I'm very against sanctuary cities. And one of the key reasons is there's a federal law, and states and cities should not undermine federal law as it relates to federal immigration policy. I think it's very important that we protect our borders and make sure there's no illegal immigrants in our country. In the same vein on marijuana, it's against the federal law to cultivate marijuana and to smoke it for recreational purposes. So what I've done, because I believe in cannabis oil, I have voted for it in the Senate. I've voted for expansions of it. For limited use and certainly low THC. And I'm against, you know, recreational use of marijuana. So what we need to do is work with the federal government to remove marijuana from Schedule 1 so that we can have a federal plan on this and not force our state employees to violate federal law by growing it here in Georgia.
So in other words, no in-state research and cultivation until the federal law changes.
Right. I don't want to put the state of Georgia in non-compliance with federal law, and I think we do need a United States solution to this problem. And so that's why, as a senator, I urge Congress to remove it from Schedule 1 and test it for medicinal purposes. But every doctor that I know is saying that there currently is not evidence of medicinal benefit, but there absolutely is anecdotal evidence of the lowering of brain waves, so it helps on seizures and things of that sort.
But the state has already passed several bills now which list conditions for which people would qualify for medical-based marijuana. or cannabis oil or cannabinoid oil, whatever you want to call it. Isn't there a catch-22 in the meantime for those people where they are allowed under state law to get treatment using that modality, but they can't get it?
There's a couple of things with what you're saying. Number one, this was a compassion issue. This was a realization that the essentially the narcotics that kids were being given were not working, and that medicinal cannabis oil was actually creating a benefit for these patients. And so we wanted to do what we could to get it into their hands. But we didn't want to violate federal law in a very large scale way. And so, yes, we left out cultivation. But there is a catch-22 in this process. And until doctors get on board and want to expand it fully at the federal level, I just don't think it's responsible to put a law on the books as governor that violates federal law.
One more thing on the subject of marijuana. You said you're opposed to recreational marijuana. Is that correct?
Yes.
Some jurisdictions, though, including Atlanta and a couple of other cities, as part of criminal justice reform, have said, okay, we're going to decriminalize possession of small amounts of marijuana. In other words, it's still a crime. You're arrested. You pay a fine, but you don't go to prison. Would you support the state looking at that approach?
One of the things that we have to look at, and it goes back to what we were talking about earlier with the social challenges that we face. We don't want to put people that we're not scared of in prison for long periods of time where then they come out more hardened a criminal than they went in. So I've supported Governor Deal's criminal justice reforms, and I've actually supported a raising, if you will, of the amount that one has to have before it's called a felony. We did that in the state Senate. So I think smartly looking at these things that that take into account the full person and criminal justice makes a lot of sense, especially around the issue of marijuana.
So you'd favor taking a look at decriminalization with a fine, but you're not sure yet whether you'd go for it. Is that correct?
I'm willing to discuss whether we would remove a misdemeanor or a felony charge on certain amounts and where you would levy a fine. Yeah, I'd be willing to look at that.
On immigration, the state legislature recently adjourned and without passing a bill that would require local jurisdictions to work with federal authorities when people are arrested. Would you push for that as governor? You said you wanted to end sanctuary cities, for instance. But would you push for a bill that says as soon as someone is arrested, before they're even convicted, they need to be reported to the feds?
Yeah, I think there's a big difference here in terms of reporting to the feds and work and not working with the feds. If the federal government was pursuing drug charges on anybody because they were violating federal law, I think it's the right thing to do for our law enforcement to coordinate with the federal government on breaches of law at the federal government. Look, we're a nation of laws, and that's the right thing to do as governor.
So you're saying if a federal law is involved, then local jurisdiction should work with federal authorities. Some measures, though, would go farther than that. They would say as soon as somebody's arrested, that person, if they're here illegally, should be reported to federal immigration authorities. Would you support that?
Yeah, I think that the immigration issue is a big enough problem in our country where it makes sense that for local jurisdictions to communicate with federal ICE agents, because I believe the federal ICE agents at this point are overwhelmed. And if there are people on the ground that can be helpful in detaining illegal aliens that are criminals, I think that makes a lot of sense.
But if they haven't been convicted yet, if they've just been arrested, I mean, obviously they've broken a law by being here in the first place, but does that make them criminal enough to have to report them before they're convicted?
I think it's very important for state and local law enforcement to work with ICE agents.
ICE agents, though, work with communities. And federal authority or law enforcement, local law enforcement on the ground works with communities to go after really violent folks. If you have a measure that draconian, don't you risk the cooperation of those communities?
I don't think so. I think people understand that people come here illegally or legally, and many of the most wonderful immigrants we have in our country came here legally. Some of our greatest citizens in our country are first and second generation Americans, and people are frustrated with people coming here illegally, breaking in line, and then getting arrested. Of course, they should be deported.
What about, what would you say to small businesses and farms that depend on that labor supply to some extent, especially now when there is a shortage of workers because of the economy?
Well, it's not just because of the economy. And this is the point I'm driving at, is policies have created illegal immigration by paying our own citizens to do nothing. You create a demand in the lower level aspects of the economy for things like, you know, picking fruit, cutting lawns, hammering houses together, and all these things that our economy needs. But if you're paying your own citizens to do nothing, then somebody's got to do it. And so we need to attack illegal immigration. We have to attack our social welfare programs.
But unemployment right now, according to the most recent figures, is hovering around 4%.
But you know,
that's almost full employment.
But you know that unemployment is not the correct indicator, because people that aren't even looking for a job are not even counted.
But does this raise the question then of how you help farmers and small business people and folks in rural areas who depend on that supply of labor?
There are opportunities currently to get legal and safe members to pick fruit currently. You know, the HB2 visa program. There's other ways to get legal work. What I'm saying is that I don't want to just suggest that that's enough. We need to address the drivers that are causing illegal immigration, and I do believe welfare and food stamps are one of those, because you're making comfortable our own citizens by not working when they could be working and doing the jobs that illegal immigrants are currently willing to do.
What would you say to someone who says, look, if you want to see how comfortable it is on welfare and food stamps, try living on welfare and food stamps? I mean, it sounds as if there's this lush lifestyle when
I don't think it's lush, but I do think that it dulls the initiative that the human being can have when they are not being given something for doing nothing.
Let's talk about religious freedom for a moment. You have pledged, along with many of the other candidates in this race, to support a religious freedom bill. That's often the name given to it, should it make it through the state legislature. Are you concerned about pledging to support something when you don't know what the exact language would be? We often hear Governor Deal say, when we ask him, would you sign this bill, I want to see it first.
A couple of things. Number one, the pledge articulated exactly what the words would say. I said I would sign a mirror image of the federal RFRA. So the language that is on the books at the federal level, I would sign for the state of Georgia. But look, I've fought on 3 combat tours in Iraq and Afghanistan. I know what it's like to be in a country that doesn't protect somebody's religious liberty, and a nation that doesn't protect your religious liberties will not protect any of your liberties. And so it's very important to restore this foundational constitutional principle to its rightful place under the law.
2 quick points on that. If there's a bill that comes out that's almost like the federal RFRA law, but it's a little bit different, and you say, okay, now we're getting into an area that I really feel might risk the state legally, and you say, okay, I'm not going to sign that, that might be a distinction that's lost on some of the voters to whom you've promised to sign that bill. Can you see that happening? What would you say to people who say, look, you promised to do that?
Yeah, I don't see that. I mean, look, I've committed to sign RFRA because I think RFRA is important. And I don't love pledges in general, I will be honest with you. But I did sign that one because I wanted to send a message to those that value religious liberty as I do, that this issue should be protected. If it's a multi-page bill and religious freedom restoration is just a single point of it, then of course I'm going to reserve the right to read all of the other things in the bill and determine whether those as well are the best for Georgia. But the bottom line is I'm committed to religious freedom restoration because it's foundational to our country and to our prosperity.
On that point, what would you say to LGBTQ people who say, look, we're not asking anyone to give up their religious beliefs. All we are asking for is non-discrimination in the public square, in the public marketplace, in public accommodations.
Well, I don't even know why you brought that group up, because they have religious liberties too, and I want to protect their religious liberties as well with this bill.
But the issue has been, let's say, either a service, an individual merchant, a government entity, whatever, whether or not LGBTQ people can be served something that anyone else is based on the private religious beliefs of the person who is providing a service to the general public.
Yeah, I don't read religious liberty restoration as an opportunity to discriminate against anyone. What I do believe religious liberty restoration does is it prevents the government from bludgeoning a private citizen into what the government wants. It allows that individual to honor the dictates of their faith, the sincerely held religious doctrines of their faith, without being bludgeoned by the government. This is a limited government bill, really. It's about saying religious liberty is very important. It's foundational. We honor it in Georgia. And let's put the issue behind us, is what I'd say about this issue. We've been arguing about it for 3 to 4 years. Let's sign the bill and move on.
Last year, before you left the Senate to run for governor, you voted for a House bill, 434 was the number on it, I think, which would ease the restrictions on eminent domain, which is the power of the government to condemn private property for a public use. The bill would allow condemnation even for a commercial entity if a government says, okay, there's some economic development purpose, for instance. During a recent Republican debate, you answered a question about that by saying, we make a lot of votes. I don't know what that particular issue was. Do you know what that issue is now?
Well, it's an issue that would allow whether you're building public-private partnerships or pipelines, key things for infrastructure, utilities, things of that sort, where there isn't a long-term or even a short-term, public use and a public good. For if an arm's-length transaction will not occur for that property, that the government will pay a fair market value for that property, and so the project can move forward.
But it can benefit a private company. Isn't there a real slippery slope here in easing those restrictions?
There could be if there's not restrictions on that, but the bill calls for the appropriate level of review prior to that happening.
What would you say though to somebody who says, look, you're a small C conservative, you're for limited government? Isn't this exactly the opposite? Government intervening to pick winners and losers to benefit private companies.
No, I don't see it that way. I see any issue of eminent domain in this case is an issue of creating projects for a public need, and you're not delegating it to the private entity unless there's going to be a net benefit to the taxpayers.
Let's talk about what happens if you win the Republican nomination and you win the race for governor. Which initiatives of Governor Deal would you continue, maybe even expand, and which ones would you say, okay, that's not at the top of my priority list?
I think one of the things he's done very well is getting us out of this recession and on a very solid financial footing, allowing for the next governor to make some very transformational changes. So very proud of that work. I also am proud of the work that we've done on criminal justice reform. I think that's been very good. I like how he has prioritized technical colleges, because when you talk about economic development, 75% of the jobs that are available don't require a four-year degree, and we need to make sure we're continuing to push the envelope to make sure people have skills they can take on the jobs of the next century. So all those things are very positive, and I would continue to support.
Anything that you would say, okay, that may have been a priority for Governor Deal, it's not one of mine?
Well, I'm very clear on the direction that I want to take the state, okay? I want to eliminate the Georgia state income tax, and I want to do budget reform in a way that's going to create a more limited and focused government that focuses on the priorities and funds them at the appropriate level so we can deliver results. But we're going to need to look at areas where we have traditionally and for many years not delivered results, and change the way we do business in those categories and or spend less money on them.
We talked about what would happen if you win. Should you lose the Republican nomination? And I know every candidate says, I'm planning on winning. But should it go the other way, would you support the eventual Republican nominee, no matter which of the people in that field it is?
The reason that I'm running for governor is we don't have forever to make some transformational changes in our state and our nation. We're $21 trillion in debt, and many of that drag on the federal dollars comes from the 50 states. We need truly conservative, limited government governors if we're going to change the trajectory of our nation.
All of your opponents meet those qualifications?
No, they don't. I believe that I'm the only candidate that's truly a conservative leader that can get these ideas implemented into policy. However, because of the sharp contrast between Republicans and Democrats, of course I will support the nominee because I believe that Democrats don't honor the founding principles of our country in terms of their economic principles, which is more akin to socialism, and the issues of life and conservative values that the Republican Party stands for. There's truly a night and day difference these days, and so yes, I would support the Republican.
Are you saying Democrats are either bad people or bad Americans?
Certainly not bad people. I think that the collectivist mindset, which you know Karl Marx and many socialists have written about and tried, they believe in that. They believe in a more socialist and shared prosperity, which has never delivered results, and history has shown that. So I don't think they're bad people. I just think they're misguided on economic policy and what's best for people.
You don't think there's any difference among Democrats, let's say, along the spectrum of thought on the left?
I think that folks that are coming out of a Democrat primary have to share values that are, in many cases, are not congruent with America's founding. I think Democrat voters many times vote D for tradition more than they do on the issues set that the National Democrat Party and the Democrat Party at large pushes. And if they were to give a hearing to the difference, I think we could earn their vote.
That was my recent conversation with Republican State Senator Hunter Hill. He's one of the candidates trying to win his party's nomination to run for governor of Georgia. Now, make sure to keep an eye and an ear on our podcast feed for more interviews like this in the coming weeks. And look for those interviews Wednesdays and Fridays in our podcast feed. And don't forget to subscribe for more nourishing conversation all about Georgia politics. You can do that with your favorite podcast app. I'm Dennis O'Hare. I'll be back in your feed soon with more Political Breakfast.
At a time when information continues to come at us faster and faster, sometimes you need to hit pause and rewind. NPR's Throughline takes you back in time to the source of the news stories filling your feed. Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.
Local, state, national politics. WABE and NPR have the coverage you need. I'm Jim Burris, host of WABE's All Things Considered. Whether it's on the air at 90.1, streaming online, or connecting through our mobile app, WABE keeps you on top of election 2024 in what's sure to be a pivotal year in politics. And for candidates and ballot information, visit our election hub at wabe.org/election2024.